Chapter 4. Repeater answer : I don't know.
How do you mean you don't know?
I don't know what dogs.
Dot, the judge again intervened :
try to tell us exactly what happened.
How long did you remain at the foot of the stairs?
Only a few minutes.
And what was going on meanwhile overhead?
The dogs kept on snarling and panting.
Once or twice he cried out.
I think he moaned once.
Then he was quiet.
Then what happened?
Then I heard a sound like the noise of a pack when the wolf is thrown to them gulping and lapping.
There was a groan of disgust and repulsion through the court, and another attempted intervention by the distracted lawyer. But the inquisitive judge was still inquisitive.
And all the while you did not go up?
Yes, I went up then to drive them off.
The dogs?
Yes.
Well, when I got there it was quite dark.
I found my husband's flint and steel, and struck a spark.
I saw him lying there.
He was dead.
And the dogs?
The dogs were gone.
Gone where to?
I don't know. There was no way out and there were no dogs at Kerful.
She straightened herself to her full height, threw her arms above her head, and fell down on the stone floor with a long scream.
There was a moment of confusion in the courtroom.
Someone on the bench was heard to say : this is clearly a case for the ecclesiastical authorities, and the prisoner's lawyer doubtless jumped at the suggestion.
After this, the trial loses itself in a maze of cross-questioning and squabbling.
Every witness who was called corroborated Anna Cornelt's statement that there were no dogs at Kerful,
had been none for several months.
The master of the house had taken a dislike to dogs, there was no denying it.
But, on the other hand, at the inquest, there had been long and bitter discussion as to the nature of the dead man's wounds.
One of the surgeons called in had spoken of marks that looked like bites.
The suggestion of witchcraft was revived, and the opposing lawyers hurled tomes of necromancy at each other.
At last Anna Cornelt was brought back into court at the instance of the same judge and asked if she knew where the dogs she spoke of could have come from.
On the body of her redeemer she swore that she did not.
Then the judge put his final question : if the dogs you think you heard had been known to you, do you think you would have recognized them by their barking?
Yes.
Did you recognize them?
Yes.
What dogs do you take them to have been?
My dead dogs, she said in a whisper.
She was taken out of court, not to reappear there again.
There was some kind of ecclesiastical investigation, and the end of the business was that the judges disagreed with each other, and with the ecclesiastical committee, and that Anna Cornelt was finally handed over to the keeping of her husband's family, who shut her up in the keep of Kerful, where she is said to have died many years later, a harmless madwoman.
So ends her story.
As for that of Herve de Lanrevain, I had only to apply to his collateral descendant for its subsequent details.
The evidence against the young man being insufficient, and his family influence in the duchy considerable, he was set free, and left soon afterward for Paris.
He was probably in no mood for a worldly life, and he appears to have come almost immediately under the influence of the famous M. Arnold Dandely, and the gentlemen of Port Royal.
A year or two later he was received into their order, and without achieving any particular distinction he followed its good and evil fortunes till his death some 20 years later.
Lanrevain showed me a portrait of him by a pupil of Philippe de Champagne.
Sad eyes, an impulsive mouth and a narrow brow.
Poor Herve de Lanrevain.
It was a grey ending.
Yet as I looked at his stiff and sallow effigy, in the dark dress of the Jansenists, I almost found myself envying his fate.
After all, in the course of his life two great things had happened to him.
He had loved romantically, and he must have talked with Pascal.
The end.
Mrs. Manstey's view was first published in Scribner's Magazine, July, 1891.
The view from Mrs. Manstey's window was not a striking one, but to her at least it was full of interest and beauty. Mrs. Manstey occupied the back room on the third floor of a New York boarding house, in a street where the ash barrels lingered late on the sidewalk, and the gaps in the pavement would have staggered a Quintus Curtius. She was the widow of a clerk in a large wholesale house, and his death had left her alone, for her only daughter had married in California, and could not afford the long journey to New York to see her mother. Mrs. Manstey, perhaps, might have joined her daughter in the West, but they had now been so many years apart that they had ceased to feel any need of each other's society, and their intercourse had long been limited to the exchange of a few perfunctory letters, written with indifference by the daughter, and with difficulty by Mrs. Manstey, whose right age, and was growing stiff with gout. Even had she felt a stronger desire for her daughter's companionship, Mrs. Manstey's increasing infirmity, which caused her to dread the three flights of stairs between her room and the street, would have given her pause on the eve of undertaking so long a journey, and without, perhaps, formulating these reasons as he had long since accepted as a matter of course her solitary life in New York. She was, indeed, not quite lonely, for a few friends still toiled up now and then to her room, but their visits grew rare as the years went by. Mrs. Manstey had never been a sociable woman, and during her husband's lifetime his companionship had been all sufficient to her. For many years as he had cherished a desire to live in the country, to have a hen house and a garden, but this longing had faded with age, leaving only in the breast of the uncommunicative old woman a vague tenderness for plants and animals. It was, perhaps, this tenderness which made her cling so fervently to her view from her window, a view in which the most optimistic eye would at first have failed to discover anything admirable. Mrs. Manstey, from her coign of vantage, a slightly projecting bow window, where she nursed an ivy and a succession of unwholesome-looking bulbs, looked out first upon the yard of her own dwelling, of which, however, she could get but a restricted glimpse. Still, her gaze took in the topmost boughs of the ailanthus below her window, and she knew how early each year the clump of Decentra strung its bending stalk with hearts of pink. But of greater interest were the yards beyond. Being for the most part attached to boarding houses, they were in a state of chronic untidiness and fluttering, on certain days of the week, with miscellaneous garments and frayed tablecloths. In spite of this, Mrs. Manstey found much to admire in the long vista which she commanded. Some of the yards were, indeed, but stony wastes, with grass in the cracks of the pavement, and no shade in spring save that afforded by the intermittent leafage of the clotheslines. These yards Mrs. Manstey disapproved of, but the others, the green ones, she loved. As he had grown used to their disorder, the broken barrels, the empty bottles and paths unswept no longer annoyed her. Hers was the happy faculty of dwelling on the pleasanter side of the prospect before her. In the very next enclosure, did not a magnolia open its hard white flowers against the watery blue of April? And was there not, a little way down the line, a fence foamed over every May, the lilac waves of wisteria? Farther still, a horse chestnut lifted its candelabra of buff and pink blossoms above broad fans of foliage, while in the opposite yard June was sweet with the breath of a neglected syringa, which persisted in growing in spite of the countless obstacles opposed to its welfare. But if nature occupied the front rank in Mrs. Manstey's view, there was much of a more personal character to interest her in the aspect of the houses and their inmates. She deeply disapproved of the mustard-colored curtains which had lately been hung in the doctor's window opposite. But she glowed with pleasure when the house farther down had its old bricks washed with a coat of paint. The occupants of the houses did not often show themselves at the back windows, but the servants were always in sight. Noisy slatterns, Mrs. Manstey pronounced the greater number. She knew their ways and hated them. But to the quiet cook in the newly painted house, whose mistress bullied her, and who secretly fed the stray cats at nightfall, Mrs. Manstey's warmest sympathies were given. On one occasion her feelings were racked by the neglect of a housemaid, who for 2 days forgot to feed the parrot committed to her care. On the third day, Mrs. Manstey, in spite of her gouty hand, had just penned a letter, beginning, colon, Madam, it is now 3 days since your parrot has been fed, when the forgetful maid appeared at the window with a cup of seed in her hand. But in Mrs. Manstey's more meditative moods it was the narrowing perspective of far-off yards which pleased her best. She loved, at twilight, when the distant brown stone spire seemed melting in the fluid yellow of the west, to lose herself in vague memories of a trip to Europe, made years ago, and now reduced in her mind's eye to a pale phantasmagoria of indistinct steeples and dreamy skies. Perhaps at heart Mrs. Manstey was an artist. At all events she was sensible of many changes of color unnoticed by the average eye, and dear to her as the green of early spring, was the black lattice of branches against a cold sulfur sky at the close of a snowy day. She enjoyed, also, the sunny thaws of March, when patches of earth showed through the snow, like ink spots spreading on a sheet of white blotting paper, and, better still, the haze of boughs, leafless but swollen, which replaced the clear-cut tracery of winter. She even watched with a certain interest the trail of smoke from a far-off factory chimney, and missed a detail in the landscape, when the factory was closed, and the smoke disappeared. Mrs. Manstey, in the long hours which she spent at her window, was not idle. She read a little, and knitted numberless stockings. But the view surrounded, and shaped her life as the sea does a lonely island. When her rare callers came it was difficult for her to detach herself from the contemplation of the opposite window washing, or the scrutiny of certain green points in a neighboring flower bed which might, or might not, turn into hyacinths, while she feigned an interest in her visitor's anecdotes about some unknown grandchild. Mrs. Manstey's real friends were the denizens of the yards, the hyacinths, the magnolia, the green parrot, the maid who fed the cats, the doctor who studied late behind his mustard-colored curtains, and the confidant of her tenderer musings was the church spire floating in the sunset. One April day, as she sat in her usual place, with knitting cast aside and eyes fixed on the blue sky mottled with round clouds, a knock at the door announced the entrance of her landlady. Mrs. Manstey did not care for her landlady, but she submitted to her visits with ladylike resignation. Today, however, it seemed harder than usual to turn from the blue sky and the blossoming magnolia to Mrs. Sampson's unsuggestive face, and Mrs. Manstey was conscious of a distinct effort as she did so. "The magnolia is out earlier than usual this year, Mrs. Sampson," she remarked, yielding to a rare impulse, for she seldom alluded to the absorbing interest of her life. In the first place it was a topic not likely to appeal to her visitors, and, besides, she lacked the power of expression, and could not have given utterance to her feelings, had she wished to. "The what, Mrs. Manstey?" inquired the landlady, glancing about the room, as if to find there the explanation of Mrs. Manstey's statement. "The magnolia in the next yard in Mrs. Black's yard," Mrs. Manstey repeated. "Is it, indeed? I didn't know there was a magnolia there," said Mrs. Sampson, carelessly. Mrs. Manstey looked at her. She did not know that there was a magnolia in the next yard. "By the way," Mrs. Sampson continued, "speaking of Mrs. Black reminds me that the work on the extension is to begin next week." "The what?" it was Mrs. Manstey's turn to ask. "The extension," said Mrs. Sampson, nodding her head in the direction of the ignored magnolia. Who knew, of course, that Mrs. Black was going to build an extension to her house? "Yes, ma'am. I hear it is to run right back to the end of the yard. How she can afford to build an extension in these hard times I don't see, but she always was crazy about building. She used to keep a boarding house in 17th Street, and she nearly ruined herself then, by sticking out bow windows and whatnot. I should have thought that would have cured her of building, but I guess it's a disease, like drink. Anyhow, the work is to begin on Monday." Mrs. Manstey had grown pale. She always spoke slowly, so the landlady did not heed the long pause which followed. At last Mrs. Manstey said, "Colin, do you know how high the extension will be?" That's the most absurd part of it. The extension is to be built right up to the roof of the main building. Now, did you ever?
Mrs. Manstey paused again. Ought it be a great annoyance to you, Mrs. Sampson? She asked.
I should say it would. But there's no help for it. If people have got a mind to build extensions, there's no law to prevent them that I'm aware of.
Mrs. Manstey, knowing this, was silent.
There is no help for it, Mrs. Sampson repeated. But if I am a church member, I wouldn't be so sorry if it ruined Eliza Black.
Well, good day, Mrs. Manstey. I'm glad to find you so comfortable.
Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.